You're listening to the Community Character Hour. We begin each episode with a newspaper clipping from the past. What is our newspaper clipping today, Hannah?
Yeah, so this month's excerpt is actually from an 1882 issue of the Old Century magazine, which was published in New York City. Hmm. So we found this because in 1910, Sandpoint's own Dr. C.S. Moody wrote up a sort of remembrance in a local paper about this article. And he remembered that one of the writers from the Old Century magazine by the name of E.V. Smalley was sent here to, quote, write up the West. Moody said of Smalley, "He wore the brand of a tenderfoot on his every lineament, and even his clothing reeked of Broadway." So despite being a greenhorn, Smalley seemed to have had a pleasant journey on his guided horseback trip through North Idaho, and he waxed romantic to no end. In trying to set a route, he said, "There is but one road, the old Mullen Road, and that is impassable before July, because of the high water in the mountain streams." His guides chose instead to take him down the Clarks Fork River to Lake Ponderay on the trail that Highway 200 follows today. So an excerpt from what Smalley wrote about his first experience in North Idaho. He said, "The great Ponderay Forest is by no means forbidding in melancholy when once you are in its depths. It is all a vast flower garden. There is scarcely a square foot of the ground which does not bear a blossom. You can gather handfuls of wild roses without dismounting almost anywhere along the trail. There are patches of wild sunflowers. The serviceberry bushes bear blossoms like the English hawthorn, and scores of unnamed flowers brighten the glades. Deer were seen every morning among the horses. Fresh tracks of cinnamon and black bears were often found on the trail, and one day a wolf trotted across the path."
Okay, 1882. This is mm-hmm. how a New York City magazine writer described Lake the Ponderay Forest, the area around Lake Ponderay.
Yeah.
I'm a little skeptical of gathering wild roses barehanded on horseback. We have a wild rose bush in our yard, and I wouldn't want to. I'd avoid it. But okay. But anyway, this is how he saw it, I guess. Or he, or it's, yeah, E.V. Smalley
yes,
was the one he who was sent to write up the West. Okay.
Well, it is certainly a romantic view of the area. This would have been the same year the railroad was built around the lake, right?
Yeah, it was that summer before the railroad was completed. So this was perhaps the last chance to experience North Idaho as a truly wild place.
And yet in 1882, not nearly as wild as the accounts we've been reading about in the 40 years earlier, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you're listening to the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack Peterson, joined as always by Hannah Combs, Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and Heather Upton, Director Emeritus of the Museum. Today we're going back to the wild place in time where we left off after our last exciting episode. Jesuit missionaries had come through this area seeking converts, but little else of note to American settlers anyway had transpired, largely due to the challenges of traversing North Idaho's rugged landscape. And that is where the Mullen Road came in.
Yeah. After nearly 30 years of contentious joint occupancy of the Columbia region, the United States and Britain finally settled on the 49th parallel as the official U.S.-Canada border in 1846.
Though the border was firmly established on paper, it wasn't occupied by American citizens. The U.S. government feared France, Britain, or Russia might assert future claim by sending their own settlers into the new territory. If the U.S. were to settle the area with pioneers and eliminate this threat, they needed to find an easy way for people to travel through the dense forest of the inland Northwest. As early as 1852, the U.S. government began to think about building an overland route from the interior to the Pacific Ocean. Yet despite the Lewis and Clark expedition, little was known about the country.
In 1853, Isaac Ingalls Stevens, appointed the first governor of the Washington Territory by newly elected President Franklin Pierce, was authorized by Congress to lead a U.S. Army expedition through the Washington Territory. It was made up of engineers and explorers. They organized near St. Paul, Minnesota. They were to detail the geographical and topographical character of the county. To do so, Stevens split them up into four parties, which would each make a different approach to the interior, keeping meticulous notes along the way. Among them was a small, dark-haired young man, Lieutenant John Mullen. Just a year out of West Point, he was anxious to prove his mettle as an engineer.
John Mullen. Mm-hmm. This is, I suppose, the man the road is named after. What do we know about John Mullen?
Well, in 1830, John Mullen was born the first of 10 children to parents living in Annapolis, Maryland, on very modest means. However, they managed to save enough to send him to college, from which he received a degree at 16, and then he went on to pursue an appointment at the Military Academy at West Point. Armed with several influential letters of support, he appealed directly to President James K. Polk. Legend has it that upon observing Mullen's 5'5" stature, the president said, "Well, don't you think you are rather small to be a soldier?" To which Mullen replied, "I may be a small man, sir, but can a small man be a soldier as well as a large one?" The quip won over the president, and he received the appointment. That's mm-hmm. such an interesting part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always assumed that the Army would be glad to have anyone
right.
who applied and was able-bodied.
But... And it can be an advantage to be small, too, right?
Yeah.
Like you can get through things easier.
Yeah. That's right. Yes, exactly. You need somebody
to reverse the land.
Yeah, and sneak into the... Yeah, mm-hmm. You can be very sneaky in that way.
It stayed with him forever, too, which is so interesting.
So one thing...
Oh, yeah.
One thing to consider is that West Point is the... military training academy, I hope I'm not getting this wrong, where you would become an officer. Mm-hmm. And so he may have been kind of poking at his stature a little bit, but I wonder if the bigger issue was that he didn't come from a family with money, because mm-hmm. I think
good point.
It was often, you know, the wealthy families whose sons would be sent to become officers. So he was really kind of hustling to get this kind of appointment from the Army.
Amazing. It's kind of surprising to me. And mm-hmm. especially, it's like, what a small world that this kid from a poor family mm-hmm. of, you said 10 kids, I think, who, mm-hmm. and he's talking to the president yeah. trying to get into West Point.
So yeah. Like, incredible.
It's a different world than we live in today.
Yeah. So he did well at West Point, and not long after graduating, he volunteered for the position on Stevens' expedition. He was assigned to Lieutenant Donelson's detail, which was directed to travel as far as possible up the Missouri River by steamboat. They arrived at Fort Benton near present-day Great Falls, Montana, in September.
Hmm. Let's put a pin in that for later, because mm-hmm. that's how interesting that you could get all the way that far by steamboat in those days.
Definitely. Yeah, uh-huh. We just had a presentation at the museum about this man named John McClelland, who was kind of following Lewis and Clark's path, but traveled all the way up the Missouri and then overland. And they think he might have been in our area like the year before David Thompson was here.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
But it is remarkable mm-hmm. how far you can go by yeah. river before it gets too shallow.
Yeah.
You have to go overland. So after rendezvousing with two of the other four parties, Stevens gave Mullen his own commission to spread goodwill among the Flathead tribe and directed him to set up a post in the Bitterroot Valley. So while all the other men have kind of met up and they've been dispersed on different missions, he's told to stay in the Bitterroot Valley in Montana. Without much further direction, Mullen threw himself wholeheartedly at the challenge. One of the only seven men in his party, Gustavus Sohan, was a talented painter and linguist who learned all of the local tribal languages and acted as interpreter, as well as creating documentary paintings of significant sites and events along the way. That year, Mullen crossed the Continental Divide six times, traveling more than 1,000 miles in search of an easy route through the mountains. The following spring, he followed the Clark's Fork down to Lake Ponderay, but caught in a heavy spring runoff, he had to abandon his pack animals and most of his supplies, making him think that that route would never be reliable.
So interesting. I wonder how that donkey got into the land. Yeah.
Just some lonely donkeys wandering around up in the woods.
At the end of 1854, he was commanded by the War Department to leave his post and report to Stevens in Olympia. On the way, he crossed the famous Lolo Pass. He figured it would be too difficult to ever consider as a buildable route. After a debrief, his commission was up, and he was sent back to Washington, D.C., where he had learned the War Department had approved, but immediately put on hold, $30,000 to fund the building off a road from Fort Walla Walla to Fort Benton.
I just want to interject here real quick that their whole mission is to find a path to build a road, right? Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, these guys on this expedition are having to cross these mountains dozens of times. And he's like, oh, just show up in, you know, May and report to Stevens in Olympia. It's like, that's what, 500-600 miles away? Mm-hmm. They're like, just make sure you're there and has to figure out how to get there.
So he's looking for the road. He crossed the Continental Divide six times in 1 year.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And before a road exists, obviously. Yeah. He's looking for the best way to do it. I guess maybe this is giving too much away, but he came to Lake Ponderay, but decided against it.
He did.
So this isn't the way to do it. And it was he ever back? He gave it one shot, I guess.
We'll see. I think it was just the one time that he personally was here. Yeah. And he came from what I read, I assume it was spring runoff season and it was flooded quite a bit. And so he was really struggling in the river. And when you're driving out, you know, toward Montana through Clark Fork, there are lots of sections of that area that are kind of cliffed out. Mm-hmm. And so he was probably having to be in the water a bit. Mm-hmm. And the force of the water and the runoff was probably just a pretty treacherous experience.
Yeah. And this was a little bit before they built the dams on the river.
So just 100 years.
Yeah. So what they're trying to do, what the War Department has approved here is a $30,000... They put it on hold, but they've outlaid $30,000 to build a road between basically Fort Walla Walla, which is the most inland point of like the West Coast, sort of. You can reach Fort Walla Walla by water. Mm-hmm. You can get a boat to Fort Walla Walla, and you can get a boat to Fort Benton in Montana. You can take a steamboat, but there's nothing connecting the two.
Correct.
So they're trying to tie those two points together.
Yeah, and they're already kind of scheming about railroads, even though they imagine that's going to be down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of the expedition to figure that out.
Yeah.
Well, he was assigned to various posts back east until 1857. So Mullen, you know, went back. As Stevens had been struggling to negotiate treaties with the tribes had become agitated by all the military operations in the territory. And the War Department sent Mullen back west on a mission. It was time to build the military road.
Mm-hmm. You mean, I thought it was called the Mullen Road.
Oh. So, there is some confusion. So the name of the Mullen Road was adopted later in recognition of Mullen. But originally, it had the very unoriginal name of Military Road because it was connecting those two forts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was imagined primarily for their use. They didn't really see other people using that road. So when Mullen arrived back west, he was immediately swept up in the Yakima War, not his surveying mission. After U.S. troops under Colonel Steptoe were humiliated by a defeat from several tribes, Stevens ordered a man named Colonel Wright to exact swift retribution. Mullen received orders to join Wright as his topographical engineer and the leader of 30-plus Nez Perce scouts. Over the next 4 months, Wright's troops engaged in two major battles and several other attacks, called even by Wright's own lieutenants as, quote, for the most part, ruthless and unnecessary. Mullen participated in the attacks, though on at least one occasion he intervened to save the life of a 14-year-old boy Wright had ordered to be hanged.
Hmm. My goodness.
Yeah, and that those events have, this is, you know, a tiny synopsis, but deep history all in themselves.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
This is happening over in Washington State?
Mostly, yeah. So around Spokane and north of there.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know when I didn't do anywhere near the research that you guys did, but I know when I was clicking around reading a little bit about Stevens, he's a fascinating character. And I think it said somewhere that like his 4 years as governor of Washington Territory was more dramatic than the rest of the 19th century combined.
Mm-hmm.
Like
most
of when you read a book about that period, it's all about Stevens.
And he was similar to Mullen in that he really advocated for his position. He wasn't just accepting a position to become governor of the Washington Territory. He had written to the president to say, I think I should be governor of the territory. I should also be in charge of Indian affairs. I should also be, he had like kind of four major jobs that he said, give them all to me. Mm-hmm. And so he was appointed and had a ton of power in this territory at the time.
Mm. I mean, another interesting guy. And we're talking about the 1850s here.
Mm-hmm.
But he, without, I guess this is a spoiler, but he dies in the Civil War. Stevens,
yes.
I think, in 62 or something like that.
And it is really fascinating to see as our story here progresses, the Civil War ties into it. So to see who wound up going to serve in the Civil War and who stayed here and, how that affected funding and all of those things.
Hmm. That is interesting.
Where were we?
This is all super important. Mullen went back to Washington, D.C., so he was uncertain of his promised funding, but he was thrilled to learn that the War Department increased his $30,000 budget to $100,000.
Mm.
And he was officially named the officer in charge of surveying the wagon route between Fort Benton and Fort Walla Walla. So, Lieutenant Mullen commanded a workforce of more than 200, including civilian workers, surveyors, engineers, and soldiers. Specifications called for it to be a 25-foot wide, graded to permit wagons to pass through all waters crossing by ford, bridge, or ferry. So, Mullen actually directed his team to clear the forest 60 feet wide to admit sunlight for snowmelt and to minimize blockage by deadfall. So obviously he had experience being in the area.
Yeah, those are two really good points that you might not think about if you were just coming from back east and had a job to do.
Right, yeah. Instead of saying, okay, so we clear 25 feet. Right. He's like, that means if the road's got to be 25 feet, that means we have to clear 60 feet. So that,
The deadfall seems pretty... It seems like common sense, but thinking about the angle of the sun and the fact that you would have, 10, 12 feet of snow in some of these areas, you kind of optimizing that to melt out as quickly as possible is pretty smart.
Yeah, he's a smart guy. The right guy for the job. So in the 611-mile trail blazed through the dense forest, over mountains, and across marshlands, and raging rivers. It was the first wagon road to traverse the northern Rocky Mountains. And once the surveys were complete, a task which took about 5 years, the road was actually built in just 2 years, which was a remarkable feat. He strikes me as an amazing project manager.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Indeed he does. Yeah, this is a... So I guess the surveying was not complete at the outset. So the first job was, okay, now we got to actually plot the route.
Yes.
And he still had not decided.
So he had taken... really detailed notes on all of his previous journeys. Mm-hmm. And I could not find clear information on whether this was just his unilateral decision to say, mm-hmm. pick the best route, or whether he had taken all of those notes maybe back to Washington, D.C. and mm-hmm. discussed it with people back there. But honestly, if they hadn't been here, they wouldn't really know. So
yeah.
Other than kind of controlling his budget, I bet he had pretty much unilateral decision making mm-hmm. over it.
Yeah. I guess, and he ended up, it's interesting and to, you know, I think to our mind, kind of surprising that he decides to go over, knowing now where the route goes, he decides to go over the mountains rather than follow the path of the Clark Fork River up to where we are. You know,
exactly.
Which seems like pretty natural.
But think of like other moments where we've seen somebody experiencing a specific place up here at a mm-hmm. specific time of year. So we have a map from right around this period of time at the museum that shows this lake north of Bonner's Ferry that doesn't mm-hmm. exist. Mm-hmm. But when the surveyors were there, it was flooded in the spring. And so they thought mm-hmm. that it was a lake. So, so one person's experience of one place at a specific point in time could influence mm-hmm. the whole trajectory of how this happened. So his bad experience getting flooded out at Lake Pendere, in his mind, he was like, oh, this is a bad route. We're not going this way. It's too dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Even though... by today's standards, we would say that path is a lot easier.
That's right.
To traverse.
And by the 1880s, riders from New York were picking wild roses from horseback as they wandered through the pastures.
I'll never get that image out of my mind.
Okay.
So Mullen's engineering prowess helped his team overcome many unique challenges the landscape threw their way. Thousands upon thousands of trees were cut flush with the ground, which would have created an uncomfortably bouncy ride as wooden wagon wheels jounced over the hard stumps in mm-hmm. between all the mud. They had to lay long stretches of corduroy road, which is effectively a wide boardwalk where they lay mm-hmm. logs down mm-hmm. parallel to the road. So they had to lay corduroy road down over many marshy areas. The easy route that they would normally follow alongside river's edges were often cliffed out, forcing them to bushwhack around. But it is a testament to Mullen's engineering that I-90's most difficult stretches today still follow his original road almost to the foot.
Wow.
Hmm. So that means that I-90 covers most of the original trail today. Can you still see any of the original Mullen trail or Mullen road?
That's a great question. So most of the trail in Idaho is covered by I-90, but several sections can still be seen. One is near the 4th of July Pass and is on the National Registry of Historic Places. So thankful for that. There's also several pyramidal-shaped stone markers that identify stretches of trail. So some of these you might drive near and never realize it. The road passed through the Spokane Valley and north of Coeur d'Alene Lake. Something to look for.
Yeah, indeed. I know from my days in Missoula that there is still, there is a road in Missoula called Mullen Road,
mm-hmm.
and I think it more or less, I think it's part of the original, I mean, more or less. Obviously, it's been changed quite a bit. It's now kind of an industrial road, and I'm sure it doesn't follow it exactly, but I think it is part of the original Mullen Road. Could just be named after Mullen too. I know, but it goes through, you know, went through Missoula, follows I-90.
There's a placemaking moment there.
Yeah.
Sure. Uh-huh. It's kind of like the Oregon Trail where you can like see like tiny sections of where the wagon,
mm-hmm.
you know, bridges were.
Yeah.
So cool. So Moland engineered the route and its accompanying sites thoughtfully and thoroughly. So most campsites were within reach of water, shelter, and firewood whenever possible. And he even carried seed with him, and so timothy and bluegrass around his camps to help feed the pack animals that they would use, you know, as they were using the road. That is so incredible. So he was just so thoughtful about the future as well, always.
Okay.
So 125 miles of the road cut through Idaho's virgin forests. So they were very dense and mountainous. They finally reached the summit on July 4th, 1961.
Aha! And therefore, this is 4th of July Pass. That's what...
That makes sense.
So that's where the name comes from, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Timothy and Bluegrass, by the way. I know what Timothy is.
Yeah.
I know what Bluegrass is. What is Timothy?
So Timothy hay.
It's a kind of hay. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So it ends up like you harvest it and then it becomes hay.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So finally, like I get to use some of my equestrian knowledge.
Yes. I didn't know that.
Timothy hay.
Yeah. Chomping at the bit.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So Timothy. That's what it's called. There they are. Okay. So they got to the summit on the 4th of July, and I assume that's why they named it 4th of July Pass.
Yeah, I was wondering about that when we were researching that. So exactly, a few miles later, they passed the Cataldo Mission.
Cataldo.
Thank you.
That's right.
Sorry. A whole new word.
Which we talked about that... We talked about that last month, right? That came up.
Yeah.
The Cataldo, yeah.
With the missionaries.
That's what happens on Monday morning.
Yeah. So,
then that was built in 1846.
Mm-hmm.
So after laying the road that would later spawn towns like Kellogg and Wallace, they made a steep climb to nearly 5,000 feet over what is now called Lookout Pass. But what was named Sahon for Mullen's artist friend? Yeah. To approach it, Mullen's men had to build nearly 2 miles of steep grade, usually pick and shovel. Gosh, I can't even imagine.
Yeah. Just carving that all out by hand. Yeah.
Strong men.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So on the eastern side of the Bitterroots, the road dropped down to Clark Forks River and through Hell's Gate Canyon near modern-day Missoula. So one of Sahon's lithographers depicts Mullen clinging to the large log as his gear flung into the river.
Mm.
Wow. So are there still, obviously, those archives are still exist,
yeah,
right?
A lot of them are held at the Washington State University Archives, and there's this incredible collection of lithographs that his artist friend Gustavus Sohan made, and they are beautiful. They're so detailed, and there are images of the camp that they established in the Bitterroot Valley. But the most dramatic of them that I found was this one of Mullen sort of flailing around in the Clark's Fork River.
It's amazing.
I assume trying to cross and got in over his head, and it just looks like absolute chaos. But
oh my goodness,
They made it. They made it through.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah.
I don't know if you plan to go into this later, but they start on the west side and move east.
Mm-hmm.
Any particular reason for that? That's just happened to be where they were, I guess.
It was probably the easiest way to bring in equipment would be my guess, because the route from the East Coast through the Panama Isthmus and up the Pacific coast to the Columbia River, and then you could ship stuff down to Fort Walla Walla. And so you could, I'm assuming that's why you could bring more equipment and more men at one time rather than ferrying everything up to Fort Benton over several little steamboats that were probably more disposed to getting either, waylaid or flooded or stuck in some way on the way up.
And they didn't do it like the Transcontinental Railroad. They famously built from both ends and met in the middle. That's not the way they did this road.
Correct. I was wondering about that when we started researching it, but it seems that they just started from Fort Walla Walla and pushed east. I didn't find any information about how or if they worked through the winters. Because I think when we were studying kind of David Thompson, you would see them taking these big voyages and then kind of hunkering down for the winter. And I don't know if they did that on this journey or if they were kind of pushing through maybe some of the lower lying areas through the winter as well. It seems pretty amazing that they built 600 plus miles of road over only 2 years. So yeah. I suspect they worked pretty long seasons.
Yeah, I would guess so.
Yeah. So he's still clinging from that log.
Yeah. Right.
But from there he went to Fort Benton and then on to the Missouri River. Within that period, they encountered quite a few obstacles too. But finally, the military or Mullen Road was complete.
Yeah. After the difficult project was completed. And you're totally right. I have the wrong date in here for when they reached the 4th of July Pass. Yeah. Oh. That must have been in 1959.
Because 1859.
Yeah. Yes. 18. Thank you.
1861, right?
Yeah. So we said 1861. I think this must have been 1859.
So I had fast forwarded to 1961 and I was thinking because the 1966 Preservation Act.
Oh, yeah.
Happened.
That's totally a typo.
Well, it's fun to see who caught that.
Yes.
Oh, we should say 1961. Okay.
So
I just threw that in.
I am only just now catching up on that. That we should, okay.
I goofed up on that.
Fun name flip. Uh-huh.
So the entire road was finished in 1860. But that winter and spring, floods wiped out substantial stretches of the road. And it had to be rerouted and rebuilt in 1861. Floods again damaged the road, and ultimately no provision for maintenance was provided by the Army. So they said, you get $100,000 for your project, but we're not putting any money into repairing it. You see this. This is the classic kind of funding model. And then after they spent all of this time and energy and money building this road for the Army largely abandoned the trail only 3 years later. Now, this probably had to do with the beginning of the Civil War and just having higher priorities than, wandering around setting up forts in the Northwest. But like most forts on the Western frontier, this road was used to solve a crisis. And when the emergency was over, when the Yakima War was over and a lot of those conflicts, the road was, quote, declared surplus by the Army. So due to winter weather and aggressive spring runoff, traveling by wagon was realistically only possible for 6 months out of the year. The steeper grades and bridges washed out every year, and the Army still did not invest any money into maintenance and repairs. So the brave travelers who took the road, anyway, did all of the repair work themselves. Despite these challenges, it was a popular route. Estimates indicated over 20,000 people, including Native Americans, used some stretch of the road during its first year after completion. Also noted were 6,000 horses and mules, 5,000 head of cattle, 52 light wagons, and 31 of what were called heavy immigrant wagons. Huh. These would be kind of the big wagons you think of with the Oregon Trail.
Oh, like the... what do you call it? The prairie schooner. Mm-hmm. Big covered wagon.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
So though the road was never heavily used by the military, it was an important conduit for civilian passage, and that definitely hastened the settling of the northwestern United States. So the discovery of gold in north central Idaho in 1860 by Captain E.D. Pierce contributed to this usage in making Lewiston the largest town in the Pacific Northwest and the capital of the new Idaho Territory beginning July 4th, 1863. It's wonderful to see that date.
Yeah, all of these things keep happening, whether by chance, like with the Mullen Road, or this was probably on purpose, I would guess, as it's just such a, you know,
exactly
symbolic day of American achievement.
Yeah, and so much to celebrate locally, too, on that date moving forward. So the Mullen Road helped Walla Walla become the largest town in the Washington Territory by 1870, with a population of 1,394. Wowzers.
Can you imagine how tiny and, like, remote all of these places were back then?
Yeah. That's interesting. And in 1870, Walla Walla is the biggest town in, and now Walla Walla is... What is it rank? 10th maybe, if that, in the state? I don't know.
Known for its best, what was it? Like Ladies of the Night tours. I think they do some amazing history tours over there, and they have some of the most preserved brothels, is it?
Oh, that's also true of Wallace.
Yeah. It's interesting.
And then we're
now
seeing...
Now it's all wine.
And then we're seeing that Idaho has become its own territory over this decade as well. So they split Washington Territory off from the Oregon Territory and then Idaho off from Washington. So they aren't states yet, but they're
starting to see,
going that direction.
See a change. So the road continued to serve as an important route until the completion of the Northern Pacific Railway. So Inter Railway in 1883... And of course, that provided a faster and more convenient way to access all of the region.
Well, what was up with our man John Mullen? What did he do after the road was actually done?
It's a great question. So he dedicated 7 years of his life to planning and building the road. So, I mean, that's significant, right?
That is it. So he was, he was busy on this for the big, that's the big chunk. Five years of surveying, 2 years of building.
Definitely something to hang his hat on. And so not to mention his dedication to Stevens and Wright. So after the completion of the road, he spent some time carefully organizing his notes and report. Then he resigned from the army and moved back east. So that, I mean, what a nice wrap up for him.
I'm so curious, and I couldn't find any information on this, that he was allowed to resign from the army in 1862.
That's interesting.
While the Civil War's underway, and he's young enough to still serve. I just assumed that he would have been asked to continue serving once he went back east.
Because of his height? I'm just kidding.
I don't know. Maybe. Or maybe I also didn't read if he, I couldn't find any information on whether he, you know, sustained any serious injuries or illness over the time that he was out west. There wasn't really any information on that. It's just curious to me that as the Civil War progressed, he wouldn't have been dragged back into that conflict.
Well, maybe he had a great plan and was able to campaign kind of out of it, because in 1862, he married Rebecca Williamson of Baltimore. So, I mean, meeting Rebecca, total different trajectory. He ended up having five children, three of whom survived. He wrote and lectured extensively, praising the untapped potential of the Northwest. So that definitely made an indelible mark on his life. Eventually, he moved his family to San Francisco and took up law, studying for and passing the bar in only 5 months. Super smart. So he enjoyed a successful career, but often said his happiest years were the seven he spent with his saddle for a pillow and pine needles for a mattress in the Northwest wilderness. That's amazing. So his life continues, but he was always like, well, you know, back in the day.
He probably was that grandfather who's always telling stories about that time.
When I was in the Northwest, everything started with that.
Mullen was in that mysterious wilderness for the early years of the Civil War, building a road that the army barely used. He isn't remembered like some of the Civil War generals he went to West Point with. He might not even be remembered at all if not for the dusty tomes that cite the road
that wasn't supposed to be named after him. But in the accounts that do exist, he is remembered as a stand-up guy, considerate, even-tempered, honest, diplomatic. He was called a man of high principles, devoted to his country. He was professional, and his meticulous reports and records were a major influence in securing the congressional backing that would enable the railroad construction of the 1880s.
Oh, wow. So Mullen had a vision that extended far beyond the ordinary wagon road. He was charged with building it. He knew his feat would show that it was possible to build a railroad to the Pacific, even through the heart of the mountains. So Mullen ended up dying in 1909, but not before his dream was realized. In his old age, he traveled back over the Continental Divide and through the forbidding bitter roots that had challenged his engineering skills. He traveled through this route for the last time, not on a bumpy and comfortable wagon ride, but on a smooth steel rails, looking out the window of the plush Pullman rail car. Oh, that gives me goosebumps. And you can say, like, I did this.
Yeah. Just to think of, like, the advancements in technology that happened over the course of his life.
A true pioneer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's incredible. I would have liked to have known him.
Indeed. Yeah, an interesting guy and an interesting crew. Still amazing to think of. I haven't taken I-90 down, taken it at least east in a while. Mm-hmm. But that they just said, this is the way we're going to go. We're going to go up to that mountain and then to that mountain. And then we're going down. Like,
it's a road I still don't enjoy driving in the winter.
I don't know. Even when I end up going to Missoula, I always take Highway 200.
It feels safer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They decided to go. They created two paths in 4th of July and Lookout Pass both.
Mm-hmm.
And just with picks and shovels.
Yeah. I can't even imagine.
Yeah. Yep. It's quite a feat. Yeah. Have you ever seen, have you seen any part of the road? Have you taken a look at it?
I haven't, but now I'm really curious about the stretch up by 4th of July Pass.
Yeah.
And I want to go check that out. I saw a photo of it and it just looks like the most peaceful little trail through the woods.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that would be neat to see. And then even, as Heather mentioned, there are these sort of pyramids made out of stones that they built as markers along the way. And
so mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly how many still exist. The main book I was referencing was written in the 1960s, and it did a really good job of documenting everything that remained of the trail at that point in time. But that's, 60 years ago now. So who knows what's still left.
And were those markers created while they were building the trail out, or identifiers after,
I believe,
for preservation?
During the trail.
Wow.
And so this was something that was common on a lot of these surveying expeditions, is they would kind of go and set those markers before they built the road. So they'd kind of, it was sort of your, like, let's look ahead 10 miles and, oh, that's our next point. So now we can try to connect the two.
It's the original yellow flag.
Yeah.
The pink ribbon.
It just weighs a ton instead of.
No one bothers to move them. Yeah. They're a great marker.
Huh. Did you come, you read the books? Were there any other, like, names or interesting people who came up? This Gustavus Sahon, he's from, where's he from? And his job was just to, like, paint pictures
as he
was going around?
Yeah. He was from one of the Scandinavian countries.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he was definitely the most interesting character to me because he had this great skill for painting or for drawing. And he made lithographs. So I'm assuming he kind of took sketches while he was out there and then he went back to Washington, D.C. or somewhere where he had access to a press and he could refine his drawings and print them. But they're beautiful. And he came out, I think as sort of a laborer initially, and then he they discovered that he had this gift for drawing, and that became more of his job on these expeditions. And then they also learned that he had a gift for learning languages. And wow. So the fact that Mullen was sent out initially with no translator, he was meant to, build goodwill with the Flathead tribe, mm-hmm. but with nobody who could speak the language. So that was definitely a challenge and really beneficial to him that Sohan had this gift for languages and picked up on the local dialects pretty easily. So he served a pretty important role on all of Mullen's expeditions.
That's incredible.
Okay. So, yeah. So Sohan, I don't know, anybody else that had any particular roles?
Because
the crew was 200, he had like 200
men.
People.
Yeah.
200 men.
Yeah. And I think if we dug into the fine mm-hmm. details, probably, but also thinking that the reason Mullen is writing mm-hmm. Memories from this trip is basically as intel that he's collecting for the army. So this is similar to David Thompson mm-hmm. and how, as we're talking about David Thompson, we're so curious about his wife and his yeah. family and his personal life. And he doesn't write about it because mm-hmm. it doesn't interest his bosses, who he's reporting to. Mm-hmm. So the same was kind of true of Mullen, that he was writing to send reports to the army, not for personal reasons. Yeah. So we don't get as much of that
juicy
flavor
detail.
Yeah,
right. I kind of wonder what became of those 200 people. Did some of them, those 200 mm-hmm. men,
did they stay?
I suppose a lot of them ended up going back to yeah. fight in the Civil War, mm-hmm. but did yeah. any of them
yeah.
stay around? Did he, can anybody who's here now kind of trace their lineage to those mm-hmm. to those guys? Let's take a short musical break. I've got a song queued up, and when we return we'll just talk about what else is coming up here for the museum and what else is going on. Mm-hmm. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Community Character Hour here on 88.5 KRFY. Ray Charles, Hit the Road, Jack. We were talking about the Mullen Road this hour, which closest it passes to us is through Coeur d'Alene. Doesn't quite get up to our broadcast area, but certainly a defining feature of the history and the growth of our area. It is, as you listen to this, if you're listening live, it's the end of July. You might be listening to a rebroadcast, or you might be listening to a podcast at any other time of year. But it is we're in the swing of it right now. Mm-hmm. It's a busy time of year.
I think
on my bicycle ride down this morning, I saw like three people that I knew just out walking
Whoa.
Around.
That's
I know,
exciting.
Which is unusual. I always ride my bike down, and usually it's just people in cars. Mm-hmm. But today, people are out.
The weather's good.
It's a good feeling.
It's late July. People are want to be outside. What do people do around the museum in late July?
Yeah,
you guys had some big events lately.
We did, yes. Mm-hmm. So last weekend we had our Pioneer Picnic, which was so much fun. We set up carnival games all over the lawn of the museum. We had so many families there I had never seen before. So it was a really just great time for people to come down, have some good food, play games. We set up a sort of general store where kids could come and get prizes for the tokens they won at the games, which was a thrill for them. So it just kind of harkened back to the simple little carnivals of yesteryear, mm-hmm. and it was a ton of fun. It was also our membership drive, and we got 29 new members at that event.
Hooray.
Which were announced with much enthusiasm by KRFY's own Gail Finley, so we're so thankful for her
mm-hmm.
Help with that event. It was a ton of fun. And then Coming up, we have our free first Saturday on August 2nd. That's this coming Saturday if you're listening to this live from 10 to 2. Admission is free. And we'll also have hands-on history activities for kids. So that's all thanks to our sponsors, Marlene and John Rourke. So that'll be a lot of fun. Come on down if you're in town or if you're looking for something to do before going to the festival. And then we're going to end out the summer with a big yard sale on September 6th. So this is kind of the end of summer yard sale. People are holding on to all kinds of goodies for us. We usually get a great selection of items at this event, and it's a fundraiser for the museum. So if you have cool old stuff that you've been thinking about letting go, it's your opportunity to donate them to a good cause. And if you're looking for strange, curious, interesting new things for your house, it'll be a great place to find them.
Okay. Is it a historical, like, themed yard sale? Are you looking for, like, old stuff?
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. ideally, yes. Uh-huh. We love cool old stuff.
Yeah.
We are not doing clothing. That's kind of the one big mm-hmm. thing.
Uh-huh.
Unless you have something really cool and old and vintage, mm-hmm. we might make an exception for that. Other than that, we just ask that you don't bring us anything that the thrift stores wouldn't take. But usually we're looking for, you know, cool, home decor, books, records, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
When will you start receiving the items?
Good question. usually we start receiving the items about a week before the event. So we'll say like that last week of August.
Okay. I'll start going through my closet and shopping as well on that day. Mm-hmm. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I use all the cool old stuff that I have. I still, you know, make use of. I don't think I have anything tucked away.
That's the way it should be.
Yeah, although I'm sure there are people listening to this who probably think that I'm mistaken about that. there's some stuff, probably.
We've all got our tchotchkes.
Yeah. Let's see. So that's the yard sale September 6th. You can make donations. I guess you take them to the museum during business hours, mm-hmm. which is
10 to 4 Tuesday through Friday and 10 to 2 on Saturdays through that weekend.
Okay.
So after September 6th, we will no longer be open on Saturdays throughout the winter.
And you can find the museum over in Lakeview Park on Ella Street if you... It's basically where Ella, right near where Ella just runs headlong into the lake, pretty much. You're mm-hmm. almost at the end of the street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm certainly, it's fun working downtown and mm-hmm. just seeing all of the vibrancy. But mm-hmm. I've been seeing quite a few groups of people. You guys are doing walking tours right now too, right?
We are. Yes. Thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So our walking tours will also go through that weekend after Labor Day. And they are every Friday morning at 11 a.m. And they meet in front of Elevate Realty at 212 North First Avenue. Tickets are $15 for adults, $5 for kids, 6 and under are free. So, it's a great way to learn kind of the basics of local history. We have 5 different tour guides. They each put their own spin on it. They each have researched different stories to share. So you can even go back again and again and get a different flavor of early Sandpoint.
I love that. What a fun thing when you have people from out of town too, just a neat activity to do.
Definitely. Yeah, we do see a lot of people that we know locally who are bringing their family members and visitors in, and it's just really fun. And we timed it so that if you want the full historic experience, you can do our tour and then go hop on the Shawnedes if you want to take their historic boat cruise as well. So you can get a full day of history in San Juan.
Okay. Bring a notebook. That's cool. Let's see. It's I don't know. It's festival time right now. We got Community Day coming up on Wednesday. I'll mention that. Got some local bands who are performing. Who is it? JoJo Dodge, Brittany's House, Harold's IGA, and The Real McCoy. All of those on Community Night. Are you guys going to any of the festival shows this year?
I went to Sierra Farrell.
Was that wonderful?
It was so good. Yeah, mm-hmm. great show. And cool. the opening band, the Broody Brothers, were really, really mm-hmm. fun as well. So, yeah, it was a great time.
Cool.
That is so great.
You going?
You know, this year. No. Oh, yeah. I unfortunately not. We've got some things we're focusing on, and my little guy's turning 4, so that's kind of. I have company coming into town, and it's an exciting time. But definitely next year. I thought the lineup was pretty amazing. Third Eye Blind. I grew up on that.
I heard that from the back deck of my house last night.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yep, they played it pretty loud. And I'm not complaining about that. That was fun, fun to listen to, fun to kind of overhear that in the distance. Well, this is the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack Peterson. Hannah Combs is the Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum. Heather Upton, your Director Emeritus of that museum. It's a position you held as well. Mm-hmm. Do we know what we're doing next month? Anyone?
Something juicy.
We might have to dive into the what's up next. Maybe the Mary Moody.
Oh,
maybe the Trail to Gold.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Following more trails.
Okay. Well, there you have it. Tune in next month. We're here on the second and the fourth Monday of the month at 8 a.m. right here on Panhandle Community Radio, 88.5 KRFY. And thank you for joining us as always. You can also find these shows archived on our website and look on the podcast page for that. And we look forward to speaking to you again about some fascinating historical facet of North Idaho. Okay.
This is KRFY 88.5 Ponderay.
Thanks, Hannah. Thanks, Heather. Time for Bird Note.